appointed time of 1:30 or so. So I will call to order the House Healthcare Committee for February 15th, 2012. In the way of announcements, it is our intention today to hear these bills, but not to work any of them. If that allows any of you to get out for a snack or something, why feel more relaxed about it. So that's the game for the day, and I think we will begin by opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 1503A. I'll ask our trusted assistant, actually she's our boss, to give us the details.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 1503A in gross requires that health care workers provide health care facilities for or at which health care worker provides a service with evidence that the worker received an annual seasonal influenza vaccination or a written declaration that the worker declines the vaccination. Requires that the health care facility to report to the Oregon Health Authority on the vaccination of the health care workers, declares an emergency effective on passage. There is no revenue or fiscal impact on this bill, Mr. Co-Chair.
Okay. Okay. I think we may as well, we have three people. I think we may as well. Oh, I'm sorry. If I could read, that would help. How about if we start with Jack Dempsey? Then we have three people, plus one more.
Is he a people?
No, he's not a people. But okay. Other people are people.
He's a lot. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jack Dempsey. I'm with the Oregon Nurses Association. Bringing you Senate Bill 1503, which came over from the Senate on Monday, a vote of 27-3. This is legislation that we put forward in an effort to try to raise influenza vaccination rates for healthcare workers. I have been part of a work group, I believe Katie from OHA will talk about shortly, for the last couple years, to figure out how we can raise rates. That group has been able to come out with consensus legislation, so we decided we're going to try our own, put something forward, and this is what we have. I will just state off the bat, ONA does believe that healthcare workers should get vaccinated for seasonal influenza. Just state that from the top. So we decided, let's look at what has worked in some of the healthcare facilities around Oregon, and what we've noticed are facilities that have a strong education campaign that includes a declination form, have self-reported rates that they can get up to 85-90%. My contention is if we can replicate that statewide in all of our healthcare facilities, we will have won at that point. That's good enough. If we can get 85-90% statewide, that would be great for Oregon. So that's what this bill does. It essentially runs that program statewide. It covers hospitals, surgery centers, and some long-term care facilities. The other piece of this bill is that there is a data collection component. We currently don't have, I won't say any data, but any good data on healthcare worker vaccination rates, why they get vaccinated, why they don't. This has that component in it, so all of the data, the de-identified data, comes back to the health authority. We will then be able to look within groups what the vaccination rates are, and for the folks that don't, why they chose not to. And the idea is, at that point, is then we can continue to run education campaigns at that point based on those issues. That is essentially the bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions. I will change one thing, some information that I didn't have when this came through the Senate. We have been told that we're the only state in the nation that currently prevents vaccinations to be a condition of employment for workers, that we're the only state in the nation that has that language that prohibits that. My research on this shows that there are actually only two states, Arkansas related to nursing homes and Rhode Island generally, that have mandatory vaccinations as a condition of employment. I just wanted to clarify what you may or may not have heard on that.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
You bet.
I'm sorry. I guess I didn't catch that correctly. What did you say? We're the only state
It has been reported by some that we are the only state in the nation that has a prohibition on allowing employers to mandate vaccinations as a condition of employment on their employees. I don't believe that's true. My research on this shows that there's currently only two states in the nation that have a condition of employment on their books for something like this.
Anyone else? There's a discussion about an amendment that would set up a system whereby if we do as you are requesting, we don't hit numbers, then we would come back with a piece that would make it mandatory.
Right.
Are you aware of that?
I am aware of that amendment. It was presented over in the Senate. I will say we oppose that amendment. You know, we brought this forward to try to come up with what I will call a first step to try something. Our coalition on this includes the Oregon Healthcare Association, which represents long-term care, AARP, other healthcare unions that want to try something, and they've jumped on board with this as something to try. I think we need to collect the data and see where we go, and if it shows later that we haven't got the rates we need to get, then we have that conversation at that time. I think to predetermine and set policy out 3 years from now is not wise. We don't know what the world, the viruses, whatnot will look like at that point.
Anyone else? Thank you.
Thank you.
Now call Patty O'Sullivan, Jody Joyce, and Diane Waldo, please. Please identify yourselves and go in whatever order you wish.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Patty O'Sullivan. I'm representing the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and I have with me Diane Waldo from the association and Jody Joyce from Legacy Hospital. And I just want to say a few words, first of all, just in response to what Jack just said. We are the ones saying that we're the only state that has a prohibition against making it a condition of employment, and that is true. There are a number of states that mandate it. That is true. What most of the states have is right in the middle, and that is neither a prohibition from making it mandatory nor mandatory. They leave it up to the healthcare facility, whether it's a nursing home or a hospital, to decide for themselves and work it out with their union or non-union employees whether they would mandate flu vaccinations or not. And that's where we would like to get. We have never asked to make this mandatory. We've only asked to take out the prohibition in law that prohibits an employer, a healthcare employer, from deciding for their own facility whether to mandate it and have strong policies or not. That's the difference. There's not just a mandatory, non-mandatory. It's really mandatory. Everybody decide for themselves, or you can't even decide for yourself. And that's where we're at, and we're the only state there. I just wanted to clear that up because it was kind of three-pronged, not two-pronged. With that, I'm going to turn it over, and then I'm going to finish up at the end.
Great, thank you. So, good afternoon. I'm Diane Waldo with the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and my current role there is Director of Quality and Clinical Services. And for Co-Chair Thompson and Co-Chair Greenlich and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify today about Senate Bill 1503. I wanted to relay to you that patients in our hospitals have a reasonable expectation that the healthcare providers from whom they seek care will not transmit the flu virus to them. Hospitals and clinics are obligated to maximize flu vaccination rates among frontline healthcare workers to improve population health and to eradicate transmission of the flu virus to patients. Oregon hospitals have made significant efforts to bolster vaccination rates in our facilities by simplifying the process, by offering incentives and developing informational campaigns about the benefits of flu vaccinations, making mobile flu vaccination carts available for employees, and offering special flu clinics for employees and their families. Internally, hospitals have also encouraged competition between patient care units to raise vaccination rates. As a result of these efforts and others, Oregon hospitals are improving collectively. hospital-based vaccination rates for healthcare workers rose to 69% during the last flu season compared to 62% the previous year. These are important improvements, but we can't lose sight of the fact that the CDC found that in the 2010-2011 flu season, the base flu vaccination rate was 58% in hospitals with voluntary immunization rates, compared to 98% for facilities with mandatory policies. Of note, the healthcare worker immunization rate for nursing homes in Oregon was 52% during the last flu season, which represented a decrease from 55% the previous year. Healthcare facilities in Oregon would like to strengthen their ability to require flu vaccinations for healthcare workers. As you've heard, current Oregon law prohibits mandating flu vaccinations as a condition of employment. What is being introduced by the ONA in Senate Bill 1503 requires those healthcare workers who choose not to be vaccinated to sign a mandatory declination. In our opinion, this does not go far enough to encourage and increase the vaccination rates in Oregon. An Oregon legislative work group has been exploring options for increasing healthcare worker flu immunization rates since last fall. A multidisciplinary group has convened on several occasions, and it includes a representative from the ONA, from the Hospital Association, from the Oregon Medical Association, the Long-Term Care Association, pharmacists, and public health staff and employees. A majority of the group was in agreement that the ONA concept did not go far enough to ensure public health. Increasing vaccination rates among healthcare workers poses a significant opportunity to improve public health and patient safety in Oregon. The Hospital Association requests that you not pass Senate Bill 1503, since the bill in its current form will not sufficiently address the improvements needed to increase flu immunization rates of Oregon healthcare workers. We seek your support to return this issue back to the work group to come back in 2013 with a consensus bill. Thank you.
Cody.
Good afternoon.
Try to see a question.
Okay, well, let's go ahead.
Okay, go ahead, finish.
Go ahead and let them finish, then we can direct questions, okay?
I'm Jody Joyce. I'm the Vice President for Quality and Patient Safety for Legacy Health. We have five hospitals in Oregon and one in Washington State. I'm here just to state that our perspective at Legacy is that this bill, while well-intended, does not go far enough, and we fear that it will fall short of its objective. Legacy has had a very strong commitment to quality and patient safety over the last 4 years. In the last 3.5, we have had a 28% reduction in risk-adjusted mortality. We've had a 58% reduction in healthcare-acquired infections. And yet with that strong track record, through the last 3 years of our own vaccine campaigns within our organization, we have only achieved a 72% vaccination rate internally because we have not been able to pull the trigger on the mandatory part of a process. There is a compelling and a growing body of literature about the importance of vaccination. Three of the things that I find the most compelling are, first of all, multiple studies that show that more than 70% of healthcare workers continue to work despite having flu symptoms. That obviously creates risk for the patients that they're caring for. In addition, organizations that have implemented a mandatory policy have dramatically reduced not only employee absenteeism, but flu experience and even mortality for their patients. And perhaps in the most compelling study done by Dr. Thomas Talbot at Vanderbilt in 2010, they looked at the fact that healthcare worker flu vaccination reduces patient mortality. So there's not only a benefit for the recipients of the vaccine, but there's a benefit for the patients that they're caring for. And part of the thing that was interesting about that study is they looked at what are the mechanisms that are statistically correlated with improvements in vaccination rates. There were only four things that they found that were significantly associated with improving vaccine. One of the things they studied that did not work was declination statements. The four things that did work were provision of vaccination on weekends and night shifts so that workers in any time that they worked were able to get the vaccine. Second, having very heavy education campaigns to help patients and healthcare workers understand the importance of vaccination. Third, feedback of vaccination rates to the Board of Trustees, that when leadership pays attention, then the whole organization pays attention. And finally, the other thing that worked was when leadership sent explanations and encouragements to their workforce about the importance of doing this. Again, at Legacy, we feel that that we've done as much as we can voluntarily to help do this, and we feel that we are creating a risk for our patients by not being able to go to a more stringent stance about being able to mandate this for our own workforce. And we achieved a 72% rate, which we don't think is high enough to protect our patients. I'd be happy to share additional information. Again, there's a massive body of literature about the importance of this issue, and I think that that information could help us have a better bill that's more aimed at the safety of the citizens of the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you. And to reiterate, again, we are not asking to make it mandatory. We were asking only to pull the prohibition from each health care employer from deciding on their own. However, we do have dash eights that would do that, but we know they're not going to pass. So we're not even, so even though that's what we would like, we're backing off of that. What we would like, though, is for this issue to go back to the committee and for the committee to come forward with a consensus proposal in the 2013. If they don't do that, or they can't come to consensus, then I think, you know, everybody tries again for whatever it is they want. One thing about this particular bill that I noted, and I'm not a public health person at all, but I did read some of the literature that these guys were so nice to send me that was massive. And one of the things that I found in a number of different pieces of literature were what constitutes a comprehensive healthcare worker influenza policy. Just what ONA has in their bill is sort of this voluntary compliance issue. Just let's keep doing a voluntary compliance, which Legacy has tried. But the different issues within a good comprehensive policy are education of the workers, education and information, get it out there, get them to understand why this is necessary to voluntarily get flu vaccinations. Who's going to pay for the vaccines, where will they be offered, what shift they'll be offered on, and where they're going to be offered, the location of the offerings, to make sure that this is easy for healthcare workers to get in at their nursing home where they work on an odd shift or in a hospital. Documentation and reporting. And that would include declination. Non-compliance by a facility. If the state said, listen, you have to have a comprehensive voluntary compliance policy, and it has to include these elements, then what do we do with a facility who doesn't do that and still comes year after year with a 52% vaccination rate? And an exemption policy, which all of them have to have, which school kids have for health reasons and for religious purposes, and that the declinations would show those. This bill only has the documentation and reporting issue in it. That's the only one prong of a comprehensive healthcare worker voluntary policy. And so we believe it needs to go back to the committee to say, where should we go, what should it include that's really going to make a difference. And it's standing on its own. You could pass it. It's not a horrible bill, but it certainly isn't comprehensive. And it's really not, we don't believe, going to bring flu vaccination rates up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Sullivan, you referenced a committee and Ms. Waldo a work group, and I guess I assume they probably are the same thing, but I don't know anything about them.
Katie, you talking
about Chairs Thompson and Greenlick, I believe the department will come up and give you a little bit of background about the committee. It was led originally by Senator Morissette and is not a statutory committee. It's a committee that agreed to work together, and they're kind of holding up to see what happens this session. They have a tentative meeting scheduled in March, and they'll come back and say, where are we going?
Senator Greenlick.
Yeah, is there, excuse me, if we pass this bill, is there anything that would stop that committee from coming back to the 2013 session with a stronger proposal?
Co-Chair Thompson, Co-Chair Greenlick, I think, to be really honest with you, No. However, if I were the proponents of this bill, I would then come and say, we already did this. Why are you looking at this issue again? That's what I would say if I were them. But I'm not them.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
This is peripheral to the subject. Do any of you know what the percentage vaccination rate or immunization rate is for the general population for influenza?
Well, the OHA tried that.
Yeah.
Chair Thompson, I don't think we know. However, actually, hospitals and nursing homes already report their percent of employees, contract employees that get vaccinations, but they don't report why they didn't. So that part would be new, but the reporting is not new. And in fact, some of the healthcare facilities and workers were taken out of this bill on the Senate side, because if they were included in the bill, it would have cost the department more to collect that information, so they were specifically taken out. So the healthcare facilities and the definition that go with that are healthcare facilities that are currently reporting, again, their rates, but not why they're declining. I don't like needles, health issues.
70% seems awfully low for healthcare workers. Are there any, do you have any comments on why 30-some percent are deciding not to?
So, Chair Thompson and Chair Greenlich, first of all, to your prior question, per the CDC last summer, healthcare facilities that do not mandate vaccination had a rate last year of 58.3% vaccinated. And healthcare organizations that mandated flu vaccine had a 98.1% vaccination rate. So that was as reported by the CDC. With regard to why people don't get vaccinated, there is, even for a healthcare workforce, so as a nurse, I think I still took convincing about why the flu vaccine was important, not only for myself, but for my patients and for my family. And so there still is knowledge deficit that is part of the gap. There still is just the logistic issue of if I put in a long 12-hour shift and then I need to think about, lining up at the employee health office before I go home, or if it's closed for the day and I need to come back on a day off, that there are logistic barriers that are also a part of people not getting vaccine. And then, sometimes there are supply issues as well, and that was certainly the case a year ago. So there are multiple issues. Again, one of the things that we've found internally in Legacy that's also supported by literature is that declination on its own does not drive a better vaccination rate for an organization.
Lastly, I'm aware of at least one hospital that has a requirement for their personnel who have not been immunized to wear masks under at least some conditions. Would this bill affect a hospital's ability to make that requirement? In other words, would we go backwards?
Yes. I don't believe so. At the same time, for the state of Washington, the Washington State Hospital Association actually is encouraging all hospitals to mandate mask wearing for individuals who have not received the vaccine. At Legacy Health, we have not instituted that process because we actually think that there is not evidence to support it, and we're afraid that we may create another vector for flu to spread by people who are not careful in how they're wearing their masks.
Yeah.
So there's that's an active question right now. The AHA last summer actually asked the same question or suggested the same intervention of requiring non-vaccinated workers to wear masks, but I don't think there's evidence to support that currently.
And Representative Thompson, this bill would not change that at all. It would not go back.
Representative Conger?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, somewhere along the line in testimony, and I apologize, I forgot who said it, maybe multiple times it's been stated that the goal is to prevent the transmission of the disease to the patient in the healthcare setting, which I can understand, that's a worthy goal. However, all of the data that has been cited has to do with vaccination rates of healthcare workers. Do you have any data that actually pertains to the effectiveness of vaccinating healthcare workers in reducing the incidence of transmission to patients?
Yes, there's actually data that demonstrates that a higher vaccination rate for healthcare workers will reduce the inpatient mortality rate of the facility. So the vaccination is the worker, the benefit is the patient. That's why we feel this is a public health and a patient safety issue.
Could you provide us with that reference?
Yes, sometime? I would be happy to
send
follow
it to the administrator.
Yes, I will do that.
Thank you.
May I follow up, Mr. Chair?
Absolutely.
Thank you for asking for the data. I was going to ask for that as well.
Oh, sorry about that.
No, that's okay. I think that the other line of questions that I have, and I think, Patty, I've had this conversation with you maybe back some time ago when we started talking about this bill. But I know from personal experience, I get a flu vaccine every third year or so when I think about it and remember it's flu season and take the time to get it done. One of the years that I got a flu vaccine, within a couple of weeks afterwards, I contracted the H1N1 variety of flu. And that was a particularly bad case of flu. So one of the questions I had is, do you know how many strains of flu we have cycling around, and how many different vaccines are there, and are they effective against all of the different strains of flu, and is the data you're going to provide to us specific about that kind of issue too, tying the disease to the actual vaccine that it's effective against?
Short answer is there are people that can answer that question. I'm not currently able to do that, but that's additional information that we could forward. There is a process of determining the vaccine components based on understanding of what strains are being most prevalent in the community. So we can forward some of that information to you.
Anyone else?
But it's also clear that in developing the vaccine, they have to predict what strains are going to be there. And I think there are three strains in each vaccine, and sometimes you miss a strain. But
I did.
Well, the H1N1 had a separate vaccine. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, that was one of the years where you really had to get two different immunizations. That was a little more complicated.
Okay. Representative Thompson, I did want to cover one other thing that, just kind of putting on my old agency hat, I noted may or may not be a problem, and maybe you can ask the department this. At the very end of the bill, it talks about this may not be enforced when the state health officer implements the Oregon Vaccine Education Prioritization Plan in a vaccine shortage. That seems really broad, and it may be that there's a measles vaccine shortage, and then all of a sudden nobody has to report their flu rates. So maybe they can answer that, but it just seemed a little vague to me, because you might want to leave it up to the state health officer when and when not to call off something.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Lastly, we call Katie King, who's going to resolve the issue for us.
Public Health Division sent the big guns today.
Right.
Thank you very much, Mr. Co-Chairs and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Katie King, and I'm the Government Relations Manager for the Public Health Division and the Oregon Health Authority. And I want to thank you for inviting me here to give just a little bit of background about this legislative committee that you've been hearing about during this discussion. And it actually was initiated during February of 2010. Then it was a special session, and Senator Bill Morissette from the Senate Healthcare Committee had a hearing about a bill to increase healthcare vaccination rates. And although there wasn't agreement at that time, he did direct the Oregon Health Authority, then DHS, to convene a work group of interested stakeholders and to develop some strategies to increase the vaccination rates, and then come and report back to the Senate Health Committee. So what happened next is we convened a group of interested stakeholders. We came up with a pretty large group, and it was more inclusive rather than exclusive, meaning that it wasn't, you would just have one person there from the hospitals and one from the nurses. We had a conference call line and a committee room, and we invited anyone who was interested and had good ideas to come. And I want to just say one hallmark of this committee is that we had excellent participation from a wide group of stakeholders, from hospitals, long-term care, managed care, Oregon Nurses Association, pharmacists, Conference of Local Health Officials, and a lot of other interested folks. And everybody came together with one goal: to increase the vaccination rates. So we worked together. We did some brainstorming. We reported back to the Senate Health Committee in May of 2010. And at that time, the strategy was, well, what can we do on a voluntary basis to increase rates? We wanted to better understand why are people not being vaccinated, and then maybe develop some strategies around that to help with healthcare worker education. We were fortunate that in September of that year, we received a report from Hooper on health-acquired infections, and they did reporting from hospitals on vaccination rates. And so we came and reported that to the committee in September of 2010, and we were encouraged to keep on working on our voluntary methods to improve. And then Uber came back again in August of 2011 with an updated report.
Who is this Dr. Hooper?
It's the Office of Healthcare Policy and Research in the Oregon Health Authority. Thank you. At any rate, the group has been looking at what are some goals that we might try and achieve so that we can measure our progress. And one thing that the group seemed to land on is that maybe to align with the Healthy People 2020 goals. And our last meeting we had in January, and at that time we did have a discussion of the legislative concept, but the group did not take a vote at that time. So that is a brief snapshot of the history of the work group. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Are we expecting a report to come out of that work group prior to the 2013 legislature? I'm hearing both sides.
Representative Thompson and members of the committee, we have not received a certain request. Once Senator Morissette retired, Senator Monis Anderson has been participating in the work group along with Senator Bates. And the agreement all along, and I think the commitment by the partners, is to keep on pressing on to increase the healthcare vaccination rates.
I am not a patient person. 2020 seems like out there.
Sure.
I'd have to leave it up to my co-chair to handle something in 2020. So it's,
I'll be here to keep an eye on it.
Okay. Yes, please.
You know, earlier you said we convened, and I'm wondering who is the we and what kind of authority that brings to the convening.
Thank you, co-chairs and Representative Kettemer. Senator Morissette asked the Oregon Health Authority to do this, and we have the immunizations program within the Public Health Division. And we convened the work group with folks, and we have been keeping minutes and setting meetings and working on reports back to the legislature at certain intervals.
Mr. Chair, another question, please. And it's focused on immunizations, or is it broader than that?
Co-chairs and Representative Kennemer, the focus of the work group is on patient safety and increasing influenza vaccination rates for healthcare workers. And so that's been the target focus.
Well, thank you, Katie.
Thank you.
I will close the hearing on Senate Bill 1503. I expect we will be hearing more on this subject from those who are concerned. And you want to be ready? Mm-hmm. You think you'll be ready?
I think we should just roll them over until we're ready.
Okay.
Just so we have a meeting.
Okay. We will schedule a work session for that bill on Friday. Be advised that we may well roll this bill forward, or anything else can happen in the, that's a formality, okay? Lots of things can happen, okay? So, and with that, I will open a work session on public hearing on Senate Bill 1504, and we have about 45 minutes to do three more bills, so called John Powell, who is a fixture before this committee.
He's got a gold card for this.
That's committee. Right, you know. If we want to know something, we call John Powell. Hearing is now open.
You say adjourned?
No. He said now open. I didn't think I gaveled it in. I thought I better do that so you were official. Otherwise, you'd have to say it all again.
It was a quick statement. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you, co-chairs and members of the committee. My name is John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Before you is engrossed Senate Bill 1504, which contains several technical amendments and cleanup from Senate Bill 89 from the 2011 regular session. That bill was designed to put Oregon into conformity with the Federal Health Care Act. And it included lots of provisions. We had worked with Representative Clem, who had an issue with a relative of his on cancellation, and got his approval for one amendment that deals with that. And we worked with the insurance division and other carriers to narrow down this bill to just items that we could get total consensus on. So it is a consensus bill that comes before you, and I'll run very quickly, knowing your time is limited, through the amendments. On page 2 of the printed engrossed bill, on line 17, you'll notice the words "to a cancellation due to non-payment of premium." And what that does is it eliminates from this section the requirement to send a cancellation for non-payment of premium. And the reason that it would be exempt under this act is there is an entire statute that covers notification of the insured in case of non-payment of premium. In essence, the insurer can't cancel that policy until the person has notice and a grace period. So that's in another section of law. This would simply require us to do two notifications, which we think could be confusing to the policyholder. On that same page at the bottom, the term enrollees on the last line is changed to certificate holders, which is the appropriate term for a group policy holder, as opposed to the term enrollee. So that's purely technical. On page 4 of the printed bill, on lines 26 and 27, this is changing the notification to beneficiaries who are not receiving replacement coverage if their coverage is going to be terminated in a group health insurance policy. There is a notice that's required to be sent to everyone, and currently the language that's being eliminated is what that notice must contain. What the amendment does is turns that notification over to rulemaking at DCBS, so that as things change or people believe something should be different in that notice, it could be done by rule. On page 7 of the printed bill, on line 12, there is an additional word, annual or, and this deals with lifetime benefits. The federal act prohibits lifetime benefits. It used to be standard that a health insurance policy would provide up to $1 million or $2 million of lifetime coverage. The federal act eliminated that, and so there can be no limits on lifetime benefits. This adds an additional caveat. There can also be no annual limits. And that was, that again, that's just to make sure that somebody doesn't come in and say, well, we can't do a lifetime limit, but we'll do an annual limit instead, which would have similar effects. So this would prohibit annual or lifetime limits on health insurance. At the bottom of that same page 7, on lines 40, it changes the definition of grievance to liberalize that so that a communication between the enrollee or an insured cannot mean that they're giving up any appeal right or review right. And that, again, is just a technical change. That insurers are administering it according to this language now anyway. On page 9 of the printed bill, actually it's on page 10 of the printed bill, lines 40, this deals with a lengthy section of law that requires an insurer, when people are insured in a group health insurance policy, to put out something that the enrollee can, or the certificate holder can, understand their rights. And there's a long list of things that must be pointed out in there. And this section deals with it. And on lines 40, this simply tweaks the language to make sure that the enrollee will understand rights for continuing coverage during an internal appeal. And again, it's the way it's being administered by insurers right now. Anyway, and then finally on the last page, there's a couple changes. On line 1, it's added the words patient. This deals with contracts that the insurer is not involved in. It gives the provider some appeal rights. This adds back in the patient or provider can appeal. That, again, was just an oversight, and it moves the law back to the way it was prior to the passage of Senate Bill 89. And finally, on line 25, we just add the standard definition of health benefit plan to that section, and it's purely a technical issue to make sure that that section reads properly. Legislative Council on the House side gave an articulate presentation on the language in sections 9 through 12. It seems that they're running out of numbers for this series of statutes. And so they have a very convoluted, that's my term, not theirs, series of words that explain how they're going to place this into the statutes. And that's that language. And if you need a real explanation of that, Lori Freeman could probably be here in 10 minutes or less. And with that,
I still might not understand.
Yeah,
it's a very difficult job to explain. Co-chairs, I'd be glad to answer any questions. The bill.
Representative Dougherty.
Hey, the only question I have is, and I don't know if this happens, but first of all, you did a very good job of going through and dealing with the tweaks. But in the part that the notification doesn't need to be given in case of non-payment of premium, what if the employer does not pay the premium and the employee does not know? Is that covered?
Mr. Co-Chair and Representative Dougherty, there is a process whereby the employees are notified if the employer does not pay their premium. And we've actually had that notice sent where, in a case where a legislator was the employer,
Really?
What's me?
On a weekend. And in that particular situation, they had used the full grace period and mailed the premium to the wrong address. So it works. I found out.
Okay. Good. Thank you very much for
your time. Mr. Chair, nobody signed up in opposition. But do you know if there's anybody in opposition?
Mr. Co-Chairs, there is no one in opposition.
Thank you.
I understand this is a carefully negotiated, well thought out, tedious process that brought us to this point. So I have been advised by a couple of people, don't mess with perfection or something
please.
Like that. But, yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, John. I will close the hearing on Senate Bill 1504. And we'll schedule a work session for Friday. And now we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1507A. Madam Administrator, if you would give us a brief, whatever, I'm going to call the witnesses while you do that so we can move things along. I would call Christina Bauman, Andrew Seaman, and Becky Strauss, please.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1507 engrossed removes the requirement that a person subjected to an HIV test gives specific informed consent to the test, replaces the word person with healthcare provider or the provider's designee, requires that the person be notified of the test and be given the opportunity to decline the test, declares an emergency effective on passage. There's no fiscal or revenue impact on the bill, and this moved off the Senate floor with 30 ayes.
Drew, you want to identify yourself and begin, please.
Thank you, Co-Chair Thompson and Greenlick and representatives of the committee. My name is Dr. Andrew Seaman. I am a third-year resident physician in Portland, and I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to speak in favor of Senate Bill 1507A, in which we propose to remove the requirement for a special, separate, informed consent process for HIV testing while maintaining an individual's right to know the test will be performed and decline if desired. I'd like to give you a little background on why I'm here and we're all here today. Over the course of my training, I have seen a string of patients coming into our emergency department with findings of advanced AIDS. Perhaps the most illustrative for me was a young woman with two elementary school-aged children who presented with an advanced lung infection that really only happens in the setting, or almost only happens in the setting of HIV. She had been in our ER 7 times in the last 5 years. And of those, 2 times she had evidence of a sexually transmitted infection. Based on the natural history of HIV, probably she was infected in every one of those visits. But chlamydia tests and gonorrhea were performed, but HIV was not. And the question is why? Looking into this further, I found that 40% of patients with HIV in Oregon present with late-stage findings, which is much worse than the national average. In 2006, the CDC released recommendations said everyone between the ages of 13 and 64 should have an HIV test at least once, and then those with certain risk factors yearly. I have not seen this ever, not in the ERs, not in the clinic, and not in the hospitals. And in fact, over the last decade or so, testing rates haven't really changed significantly. So I thought, just like any good public health screening process, we should systemize this. And I tried to set out to design an ER-based screening project in my own hospital. What we found was that while the staff was willing and the tests were cheap, we didn't have the resources to perform a full medical informed consent process. The same process required of us to take with the patient prior to taking someone to surgery, and the project hit a wall. So the current law was written in 1987 in a very different time. It is steeped in the very complex history of HIV and the HIV epidemic. And this is the 21st century. HIV means something very different today. We have new treatments. The average patient at the age of 20 lives an additional 50 years with the disease. And I think it's time for a change. You may hear today ACLU say that HIV testing should be held to a different standard from other medical tests. And I'd like to share some comments from Michael Kaplan, who couldn't make it today, but he's the executive director of the Cascade AIDS Project, which is the largest and oldest HIV service organization in the state. He is, and the organization is, in very strong support of this bill. And I think as an organization run by predominantly HIV-infected individuals whose sole goal is to prevent HIV transmission, provide support for HIV-infected patients, and decrease stigma, that they are in a better position to decide whether or not we really should set this testing apart from other tests. I'd like to close by reading something from his testimony that I think is illustrative. He says, from a personal perspective, I've lived with HIV for 20 years, and I can say that for the first time I can see a way to break this epidemic, but it will never happen if we continue outdated legislation that creates added barriers to testing. And with that,
Chair, can I ask Andrew a question?
Please.
Andrew, does this do anything to take away the protections of the results of an HIV test that are in statute?
Co-Chair Greenlick, no, this does not change any of the confidentiality protections.
Ms. Bowman?
Yes, thank you. Chairs Greenlick, Chair Thompson, and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Christina Bauman. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today in favor of Senate Bill 1507. I believe that this measure presents an opportunity to make an important change to the HIV testing policy in Oregon. I am a primary care provider in Portland. I'm also a preventive medicine resident and a student in the Masters of Public Health program. And from this viewpoint, I've been concerned about the gap between the public health need to increase testing rates and what is feasible in clinical practice with our current HIV testing policy. The current law in Oregon requires a separate medical informed consent before you conduct an HIV test. And to put this law in perspective, for other serious infectious diseases such as hepatitis C, syphilis, tuberculosis, or for screening for other serious medical conditions like diabetes or cancer, we don't require that an informed medical or a medical informed consent process occur before you conduct that test. The requirement to do so specifically with HIV really started from laws created 25 years ago. And as Andy mentioned, there have been dramatic improvements to the tests, to treatments. And today, early identification and treatment really improves morbidity and mortality and really makes a big difference in decreasing the transmission of the virus. We had a couple of speakers who couldn't make it here today, and one of them was Dr. Todd Korthuis, who is the director of the HIV research program at OHSU, and he's also a HIV clinic provider. And in 2001, he published a study that looked at what the barriers were for a clinician to actually doing routine HIV testing, which has been recommended since 2006 by the Centers for Disease Control. And one of the recurring themes that came up again and again was that providers felt that the informed consent process was a barrier to them actually being able to take the time to do that and then conduct the test. And so they really weren't testing as they should be. And this was especially true in states that had more restrictive informed consent requirements. So I think you can all understand this if you were to conceptualize what has to happen in a primary care encounter. There's certainly a long list of recommended preventive services. And so I myself have found myself thinking, if I have to conduct an informed consent before doing an HIV test, wow, I've got limited time. I'm going to put that lower down on my list, maybe address it next time. And the end result being that my patients are less likely to get the HIV test that they should be getting. So I really think that the most important thing to do to increase testing is to make the process simpler, to streamline it, and in this way also in developing the policy, create one that makes it easier to innovate in how these screening programs can be set up. So I believe that Senate Bill 1507 does all this. And I think in Oregon we've been realizing over time that we haven't, with our current testing policy, we really haven't been, there's been a lack of progress in finding and treating HIV infection. And in 2005, we took the step to, with prenatal HIV testing, to exempt that from the informed consent process. And I think we should also do the same for other people that are at risk for HIV infection. So to close, I would like to also bring up that we have received formal support from the Cascade AIDS Project, also from the Gary Oxman, who's the Tri-County Medical Officer, from the Multnomah County Health Department, from the American College of Physicians, the Oregon chapter of the American College of Physicians, and also from the Oregon Medical Association. And it's my sincere hope that you all here today will also be in support of Senate Bill 1507. Thank you, and I welcome any questions.
Well, the whole questions are dealt with. The three of you have justified them with questions.
Co-Chairs Thompson and Greenlick and members of the committee, my name is Becky Strauss. I'm here testifying on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon. Excuse me, a little tongue-tied. I did submit written testimony, so I'll just take a second to summarize where we are on this bill. I think our central concern at this point is that the bill as written allows for notice an opportunity to decline testing to be embedded into a general medical consent form. We'd much prefer that it be conspicuous, and we're concerned that allowing it to be in the consent form without any further restrictions, like making it conspicuous in the form, risks that the patient doesn't actually receive notice. So the bill has maintained some value for treating HIV uniquely because we're preserving a notice and an opportunity to decline testing. And the ACLU supports that preservation of notice. And I think without further clarification on what that general medical consent form is, I think that we risk dismissing that value of having notice and opportunity to decline. So in sum, I'm not sure if I'm being very clear, but it's kind of a nuanced point here and a small concern that I think can be addressed, but we would like to see something in the bill that says that the HIV, notice of HIV testing and opportunity to decline truly be conspicuous in the consent form if the provider chooses to use that path to notify patients. I'm happy to discuss that or answer any questions.
Question. Why in this day and age would this test be any different than any other diagnostic test? It seems like in even using this particular system, we're putting a stigma on this. I mean, we don't have any kind of exception or route we take on any other diagnostic test, do we, including sexually transmitted diseases? It seems like, I guess what I'm thinking is, I think we've maybe gone far enough into the future that we can start to realize this is a disease state. People get HIV for a variety of reasons, and it's important to know who has it and who doesn't. It's a public health issue as much as anything else. So why not just, it's a test?
Chair Thompson and members of the committee, Dr. Seaman and I completely agree with everything that you've said, and so maybe I'll turn to Becky here.
Sure,
her viewpoint.
Sure. Co-Chair Thompson and members, I do think we've come a long way, but there, and this is really just comes down to a point of diversion between, and I had a great conversation with Michael Kaplan at Cascade AIDS Project the other day. We, of course, agree on a lot of things like the need to combat social stigma for HIV, and we simply come down in different places. The ACLU still thinks that there is something, again, though we've come a long way, there is something unique about HIV. It carries a unique overtone, stigma, call it whatever you want, that deserves notification. And I think where we are now is asking for a conspicuous notice in a general consent form is not too far off from being on the same page as the proponents. But just we still think that there is something unique. And if I might cite an example or two, and I've cited that in my written testimony as well, and we're seeing in certain states they're put folks with HIV into solitary confinement in correctional facilities. I think there was an example out of Indiana recently this summer where a gay man, I think actually perceived to be gay man, was denied from giving blood. You know, we're seeing these things continue, and we just think that there should be attention to it.
Just seems to me that although this is an improvement, we are perpetuating the stigma that ought not be there. Representative Hoyle.
I think to build on that, a disease is a disease is a disease, and coming from a place where I have quite a few friends that died of AIDS, and when we first started learning about this disease, there was very much a stigma that prevented people from wanting to go get treatment or tell people. But I think that further isolating or treating this disease and how we test for whether or not someone's HIV positive, treating it differently is saying that these people are actually different, that they're in they should be segregated, they should be treated differently, when I think what we need to do is treat this no differently than we would anything else. That, again, you can prolong someone's life, we can help protect public health, and there are privacy protections around how that information can be shared. But at the end of the day, we have come a long way and fought long and hard to ensure that people with HIV can lead long, normal, productive lives and should not be discriminated against in any way. And I understand what you're saying, and I really appreciate where you're coming from, but there's no way that I could support something that further segregates a population that, again, should be just as much part of the mainstream as you or myself.
If I may, Representative Thompson, Representative Hoyle, just to clarify your question initially, Representative Thompson, the reason why we arrived at this legislation is actually, Dr. Bowen and I actually started out with that bill, the bill that you referenced to, actually just making this test the same as every other test. After discussions with Cascade specifically, they felt that, yes, HIV is still a special disease, and we want to be in a place where the stigma is insignificant enough that we can make it like every other test because of some of the reasons listed by the ACLU that we aren't there yet. I personally feel that logic, it might kind of come in on itself a little bit, that we are still perpetuating stigma by separating these tests, but we felt that they were in a better position than us to make that assertion, and I have a lot of respect for Michael Kaplan and their organization, and we defer to them on that measure, but we are in full agreement with you.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I guess more comment. It's interesting. I served in the Senate in the 80s and 90s when we did the landmark original legislation, and it was a very tedious and difficult process because people were extraordinarily sensitive to the issues of privacy and potential retaliations and discrimination and everything else. And it's interesting to come back 20 years later and realize the times have thankfully moved forward. And I'm very appreciative you're bringing this forward. I think we ought to realize that maintaining the stigma is detrimental now, whereas protecting the identity and, well, we'd still protect the identity, excuse me, that was misspoken, but dealing with this in a more practical, pragmatic way, it's in my mind totally appropriate.
Representative Dory?
Okay. And Dr. Seaman, the question I have is, even though this is a 21st century kind of, there still is, you still have to get special consent now for the HIV AIDS testing. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
I just, I don't know why this irritates me, but it's just the same old stigmas that we keep dealing with over and over again, and then we put together legislation that dresses them differently, and we act like that, you know. And I appreciate what you're doing and the limitations, but we're not getting where I think we ought to go as a society, and starting with the fact that we long ago recognized HIV is not a gay disease, it's a population disease. And I think it's still spreading, if I have the statistics right, in the heterosexual population. It's just, you know, come on, it's not, let's do it. So we have a special guest today that with great trepidation I'm going to allow him to testify, although his request came in late.
Yes.
And he is specifically instructed that we will be out of here on time. We have one more bill to hear, so I'm expecting bullet points.
We don't get a committee vote on this?
No, he pulled
Mr. Co-Chair, yeah. Thank you for using your chair's prerogative and allowing me to testify on behalf of this bill. Thank you, members of the committee. I first of all want to point out a little bit about medical education. I think Christina and Andrew today point out the way we're
Chair Greenlick, could you introduce yourself?
I'm sorry, I'm saying I am the co-chair.
That was nicely done. That was
nice to me.
That was good. That was good.
I do want to point out the fact that we are now training our residents and students to think about population-based clinical practice as well as individual-based clinical practice. And there, I think, about the fourth set of residents over the last 4 years that have brought us legislation, all of which has passed. I do want to speak in favor of this bill. I definitely concur entirely, Representative Thompson, with your statement. I opposed the bill when I first
met really worries me.
With Christina and Andrew and urged them to do something else. I then went with them to the Cascade AIDS Project, heard about the sensitivity that Mr. Kaplan presents on behalf of the AIDS. I think this is a good step forward. I would urge us to not change it in the way ACLU would like it, not change it in the way you and I would like it. I think this is a good step forward, and I would urge us to move this bill forward, which really does take away a huge barrier. It still doesn't deal with the way we ought to deal with it, and they believe we ought to deal with it, which is HIV/AIDS is another reportable disease like syphilis and gonorrhea and chlamydia. It should be treated exactly that way, as a reportable disease, not as any other. I think it is different than treating for than testing for diabetes. But and I'd like OHA in the public health divisions, we've been talking to them for some time, to think about the general consent processes for reportable diseases, which they have not done. Thank you.
Thank you.
I assume you won't waste time with any questions of me, but I did want to get this on the record.
Anybody want to grill?
Here's your chance.
How long do we have?
Do we have to stick to this topic?
Okay. With that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1507, and we will schedule a work session for that at the earliest possible date. Will be Friday.
And also for the record, I want to acknowledge some written testimony from the Oregon Medical Association in support of Senate Bill 1507A.
And with that, I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1565A and call Lynn Bergstein and Bill Cross. While they're coming up, I'd like to take the opportunity to congratulate these two gentlemen and several other people. This has been a landmark contentious bill that I think we actually found consensus on. So that's what we strive for in this building and seldom get. So please.
Well, try not to blow it then today, my testimony. Co-chairs Thompson and Greenlink, thanks very much, members of the committee. My name is Len Bergstein. I'm testifying on behalf of my client, ZoomCare, in support of Senate Bill 1565. This bill addresses a modest but meaningful reform in the delivery of primary care by authorizing the dispensing of certain medications at drug outlets established to provide convenient and complete care, like the neighborhood clinics of Zoom Care. If passed, this measure would increase access to higher quality care, decrease costs, and create new employment opportunities for the healthcare workforce of the future, which will rely increasingly on physician assistants as key members of the clinical team. Amendments have streamlined and improved the bill to ensure that there's collaboration around clinical teams of PAs, doctors, and pharmacists. The bill's provisions maximize patient safety. Highlights of Engro's Senate Bill 1565, which passed the Senate 27-1, are as follows. Trained physician assistants would be authorized to dispense a limited formulary of non-narcotic drugs under the supervision of physicians. The Medical Board and Board of Pharmacy would jointly develop a drug dispensing training program. Pharmacists would be retained by the clinics to write policies and procedures for drug safety that would be approved by the Board of Pharmacy. The clinics would be approved by Board of Pharmacy as drug outlets. The Oregon Medical Board would authorize PAs to dispense according to their rules, and the current dispensing authority for PAs in underserved communities would not be affected. Lastly, let me say, Mr. Chairman, you made some kind remarks about the consensus. I think we're here today because you, both co-chairs and members of this committee, encouraged us and other key members of the community here to keep working at this topic. And we did. We met a number of times during the off-season, the interim. Bill Cross and members of the Pharmacy Coalition and other stakeholders met, came forward. We really had a chance to exchange ideas and I think find a consensus. This bill is I think, the product of that hard work, and hopefully you'll it'll be something that you'll appreciate and pass also.
Mr. Cross.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bill Cross. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Pharmacy Coalition. I just want to add to the remarks made by Mr. Bergstein that our coalition has appreciated the opportunity to work with Dave Sanders and others in trying to address some of the patient safety issues that we were concerned about in the 2011 session. And we've worked through that. We believe the amendments address that and will provide appropriate opportunities for the Board of Pharmacy to work with these as regulated drug outlets in terms of the formularies that they're dispensing. We also believe it will be hopefully a pathway then that as other prescribers, other providers move forward in seeking dispensing authority under, we hope, limited situations, but acknowledging that healthcare is changing, that this may provide that kind of pathway as well for future prescribers.
Mr. Chair, it's safe to say that up until this point, Bill has been the cross that Len has had.
So we are getting towards the end of session, I think. I do think. That was pretty heavy.
Are there any other comments or questions, Representative Parrish?
Well, I just like to say thank you guys for working on this. When this bill came forward in the last session, you know, as the consumer person on this committee, with a mom with three kids who just wants to get in and out and not have to make a lot of stops with sick kids, I'm very pleased that this is moving the dial forward for consumers and, certainly healthcare choice and convenience, quite frankly, and that this is the kind of one of those bills that's kind of the start of some of these conversations around transformation. I know we're talking about it, and certainly in the payment, the federal side, but, you know, this is on the fee-for-service side. We're going to have that conversation about transformation as well, and I think this is a good first step to that, and I'm just really pleased that you guys went in and put in the work and brought us back something that, I think I can go back and talk to people in our community. We have Zoom Care in our community and say that, you know, these are good options when you don't have insurance and that the healthcare is convenient. So thank you.
Appreciate care.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Similar to Representative Parrish, just thank you for working. It's an innovative idea, and it's going to work great for a few. And I think that's exactly right. We ought to do the things we can. So, appreciate it.
Anyone else?
Hi. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, and thank you also for the work that you've done on this. I pass a Zoom care often, not quite in my district, but on the way home all the time. I'm curious in the collaboration that you've had, because it seems very extensive, a couple things. One is, did you consider nurse practitioners at all in addition to PAs, what the discussion was around that?
Co-Chair Thompson, Co-Chair Greenlee, Representative Kenny Geyer, we did. The initial bill had nurse practitioners in. We couldn't kind of work out quite the language, and so the nurse practitioners decided that in order to make this step reform move possible, they were willing to step aside, watch the bill develop, and then come back in next time if it was appropriate. So I thought it was a pretty courageous position on the part of nurse practitioners.
We also have a statute about nurse practitioner dispensing in rural and underserved areas already.
That's correct.
So this would have just extended.
Yeah, that's so. We love to have nurse practitioners at our clinics, and so we'd love to be able to make this work maybe next time as everybody gets more familiar with the rules and regulations.
Okay, thank you. And a follow-up. We previously examined legislation around transparency around contracts with pharmaceutical companies through pharmacy benefits managers. Does Zoom Care use PBMs? Do you know?
I'd have to check on that. Co-chairs and Representative, let me get back to you directly.
Okay. So I'm wondering maybe if when you get back, if you do, and whether you have an opinion on whether how that particular legislation might impact your access and delivery of services. I'm interested. It's a hot question. Topic right now, so I'd love to get
for the question. Yeah.
Thank you.
Anything else?
Just acknowledge for the record that the Oregon Society of Physician Assistants submitted a letter in support of Senate Bill 1565A.
Thank you.
And Bill, you're saying the Pharmaceutical Association is also in support of this bill.
Mr. Co-Chair, we're very supportive of the amendments to this bill. And I don't really have the authority to say we're supporting the bill, but because the coalition can't speak for the two professional associations it represents, but we believe it's good legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
With that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1565, and the work session for this will be scheduled for Friday at the earliest.
Thank you.
Are there any other problems, comments, questions?
Next committee.
Hearing none, the House Health Care Committee is now adjourned.